A recurring theme in the Evolving Leader Conversations is the shift that organizational life has and continues to make, forged through rising demand, uncertainty, speed of change, and the need to create a more agile, empowered, and creative workforce. As organizations and their leaders struggle with managing the paradox of order and chaos to deliver against short-term market expectations, while simultaneously growing, innovating, and adapting, the old, inflexible, but comforting command and control models are failing, despite many clinging to them. New ideas about freeing people up to do their best work in this new age of uncertainty are badly needed. One is psychological safety, a term coined by the researcher Amy Edmondson that reflects a basic human need to feel safe, regardless of the uncertainty, stress, or fears that might be present. Edmondson stresses that this is not some utopia where people are protected from the reality of needing to deliver results, or that they may lose their jobs because of new market realities. But importantly, that they are free to speak openly, to feel involved, to be able to contribute and influence outcomes, regardless of feeling that fear. And they can do this knowing that they won't suffer blame, embarrassment, or punitive measures. In this show, we talk to Stefan Wiedner about how he's operationalizing psychological safety in organizations and what he's learning.
Hey folks, welcome back to the Evolving Leader Podcast, the show born from the belief that we need deeper and more committed leadership to confront the world's biggest challenges. I'm Scott Allender.
And I'm John Gomes.
How are you feeling today, Mr. Gomes?
I am feeling a little tired, actually, to be honest. It's been a pretty frantic time in the last couple of weeks with Queen's funeral and the outpouring of angst that everybody's felt around that that hasn't gone unnoticed in our family. So feeling a little bit fatigued, but it's Friday, so I'm gonna get some recovery this weekend. How are you feeling, Scott?
I'm feeling a bit tired. I'm feeling the joys of autumn in the air, though. It's a lovely day. I was out earlier this morning, and it just had all the feels that everybody tends to like around this time of year, so I'm feeling appreciative of a change of weather. And I'm also feeling really excited about our conversation with our guest today. Today we are joined by Stefan Wiedner. Stefan is a psychological safety expert whose work focuses on developing sustainable high-performance leaders, teams, and organizations. His passion for unleashing the collective potential of people has led him to co-found Numi.com, the web's largest network of independent life coaches, as well as Skillsetter.com, which is the deliberate practice platform for interpersonal skills, and Zarengo.com, the psychological safety training experts. His writing has been featured in Forbes, Entrepreneur, and other popular publications. Stefan, welcome to The Evolving Leader.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
Welcome to the show, Stefan. How are you feeling today?
I'm feeling, I just came from the gym, and so I have that feeling of satisfaction, but also mixed with fatigue. I can feel my muscles and my body just a little bit tired, and so ready to end this day and end the week. It's Friday, and it's always a good time.
Yeah. Well, let's jump in, because I love the psych safety conversation. I've taught workshops on this myself, and as common as the terminology seems to me, I still find that many leaders haven't heard the term psychological safety. So maybe to get us started, can you give us a working definition of the term?
Yeah, sure. So the definition, as provided by Amy Edmondson, who's the Harvard researcher who's really popularizing and doing a lot of the front-end work to research this topic, describes psychological safety as a belief. So it's a belief that within your team, you can speak up, say what's on your mind, express concerns, share mistakes without any fear of reprimand. And we like to use a definition which is maybe a little bit more palatable or actionable, and it is the courage to speak up and the confidence to know that you'll be heard.
Mm.
And I think often, in our experience at least, when leaders first encounter that, they kind of get a bit binary around it, which is that making people feel okay isn't always okay, because there are difficult things to confront. There are consequences of, you know, having difficult conversations. And so, you know, when you look at organizations like Google and, you know, their research at Project Aristotle that showed how psychological safety played into high-performing teams, it's not without consequence, is it? So it's interesting to know what your take on that is and how you kind of assess that.
Yeah, absolutely. And psychological safety, I think, can sometimes be construed as this kumbaya, let's all hold hands and sing around the campfire kind of feeling, but it's about high performance, and high performance is going to invoke a variety of feelings within people. And some of that is stress, and some of that is confrontational and being perhaps in your face, a little bit jarring, and that's okay. So there's a variety of emotions when teams are running hot, when stakes are high. And so, that's, I think, one of the misunderstandings we see commonly is that leaders think that it's all about being nice or polite, which it is not.
So what happens in your experience when leaders do make that mistake and, you know, are incredibly nice, but perhaps don't hold teams to account for what they're meant to deliver?
Well, that's when you get into this place where the culture is perhaps mostly recognized with politeness, and there's a lack of rigor around the accountability and results and dependability. And so that ultimately, I think, in the long term, degrades psychological safety and degrades the performance of the team.
Why psychological safety for you? What got you into this topic in the first place?
Well, I've been in the coaching space for about 15 years, and executive coaching, leadership coaching, performance coaching, etc. And what we discovered is a problem around measuring the efficacy of coaching. How do we measure the impact of the coaching? And when I looked at all of the engagements, I realized most of the engagements that we're doing, we're trying to help some leader be a better leader, right? Help them delegate better, help them empower their team more, or treat others with respect, or et cetera. And then I came across Amy Edmondson's book, The Fearless Organization, and light bulbs just went off. I thought, ding, 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 this is perfect. If it's not explicitly stated, by and large, every single coaching engagement we were doing was trying to have that leader or manager improve psychological safety in their team. Even if they didn't know it, that was ultimately what they were trying to do. And so I thought, This is perfect. This is another external measure that we can employ to assess the efficacy of coaching and the value that we're generating for organizations. So we can measure psychological safety before the coaching, and then we can measure it after. And we can see, how is this leader doing in terms of facilitating psychological safety? So that was how I first got into it. And then it was kind of like a can of worms. You know, once you start, once you open that thing up, then you realize there's so much more to it. And then that's when we started exploring the research around the counseling research and interpersonal skills and all this sort of stuff. So it's really expanded from there, from just a extra measure that we're using in coaching.
So what is your assessment process when you go in to work with these teams and leaders who may not have an accurate assessment of their cultures, how they're being perceived, whether it's being too polite or not kind enough? I mean, what is your process you take them through?
It's quite simple. There is an assessment developed by Amy Edmondson to measure psychological safety, and it's a 7-question survey. So it's very quick and easy. So it's not some 120-point question survey that is sometimes administered for psychometrics. So it takes a team and its members 3 to 5 minutes to fill out this assessment. And then we have the results. Now we have everyone's perceived snapshot of psychological safety in that moment. And then we can debrief the results with the team. So it's really mostly a conversation starter, because when you measure it and assess it, now it takes a little bit of the guessing work out of it for leaders and managers. Because often when I'm talking to leaders or managers, I might ask them, well, to what degree do you think psychological safety exists in your team? And they might, well, I think it's pretty good. Well, how certain are you of that answer? And that's when they're not always so sure. And I say, well, why question it? Why don't we just measure it? There's a thermostat that we can put in the room where we can check the temperature. So why don't we do that?
And so what happens when that mirror is held up to the team and to the leader? What do you experience in those kind of conversations typically?
Well, typically, provided that we've set the stage correctly and created an environment where people can feel safe enough to speak up, it generates some really interesting conversation around why there's a certain range of results, because that's one of the outcomes that we produce for the teams. It's not just, here's your score. Let's say it's 75 out of 100. Instead, we show you your average score plus a standard deviation. So how much variety is there within your team? Is everyone feeling like it's 75 out of 100? Or do you have half the group thinking it's 100 and half the group feeling like it's around a 50? That's a big difference. And so that's where a lot of the skills come out, where we need to facilitate the dialogue within the team to understand how there's different people in the room feeling a different sense of safety for a variety of reasons. And generally, that dialogue ends up opening a lot of eyes, because most people don't realize, oh, wow, those two people over there, they're brand new to the team. They're feeling a little less safe. Plus, there was that incident that occurred 2 months ago, and this was the result. And so ever since, people have been feeling a little uncertain about what's okay to say or do within the team. So these norms develop. That's usually what we end up uncovering, is that there tends to be these norms that develop within the team that tell people this is how you operate within this team. And then those norms are not explicit. They're just implicit. And they pervade the behavior and control how people show up in the workplace.
So let's just dial back a bit and go, why do we need it in the first place? Why do we need psych? Because it may seem obvious to some people, but it may not seem obvious to others. What does psychological safety deliver in terms of performance?
You're right. I don't think it's always obvious for folks, and yet it is for me. So for team to perform really well, and this is coming from, again, from Amy Edmondson, what she's claiming is that psychological safety is perhaps not equally important in all environments. And where it is most important is when there's a lot of creativity and innovation and collaboration required in order to achieve results. So if you're on a factory floor and everything is mechanized and perfectly set out, well, perhaps psychological safety is less important there versus in an environment where you're trying to create the next new Disney production.
Or environments of safety too, right? Think about hospital environment where perhaps, you know, a nurse spots something that might harm a patient or whatnot, but is afraid to, you know, raise that with the doctor because that doctor yelled at her or him the previous time. And so they don't say anything, and then, you know, disaster strikes.
Yeah, we're definitely seeing that in more and more organizations where a injury or death is a major incident for the learning and development department. So their learning development department is responsible for making sure that people perform at the highest level possible. And in those environments, a death or an injury is really something they want to avoid with the utmost precision, I guess. And so in those environments, what they're enabling is psychological safety to occur so that those types of incidences can be mitigated. And what they're realizing is the closer you get to the shop floor, if you will, or to the folks who are doing the work, you need those folks to be able to communicate and say, hey, this is what I'm noticing. I don't think this is safe. Maybe we can do things in a different way, or perhaps creating and contributing to any sort of action plans that mitigate potential risks in the workplace.
So in Amy Edmondson's work, she talks about the fact that this isn't about removing these feelings of anxiety around difficult conversations or conflict. They're about creating the conditions in which we can feel those things and confront each other and have those conversations without the fear. So the desire to do it outweighs the risk, as it were. Can we talk about the kind of feeling of vulnerability that you have to start becoming tuned into in order to be able to do that?
Yeah, that's a great point. So back to the story of the hospital, there's, you know, the incident that is often spoken of or shared is you have this doctor and a nurse, and then the nurse notices that the wrong dose or the wrong medicine is being administered. So confronts the doctor on it. And the doctor turns around and says, hey, stay in your lane. I'm the doctor here. Don't challenge me. So then the next week or 2 weeks later, the nurse, same nurse, notices that on the chart, there's the wrong medicine or wrong dose to be administered for a child or a tiny infant. And it's 2 a.m. and they think, should I call that doctor? Because I don't think this is the right dose. And this is a potential life or death situation. And meanwhile, the psychological safety of this nurse is being hindered by this one event that happened a week or two earlier where they were told to stay in their lane. And now they don't pick up that phone. And this is all happening in fractions of a second. And I don't think it's being fully processed by individuals. And in that particular case, the nurse, they're just, okay, I'm not going to pick up the phone because I know I'm going to get reamed out by this doctor, especially if it's 2 a.m. And so this happens all the time. And so for a leader, you want to be able to create that environment where people can call you at 2 a.m. with potentially bad news or potentially news you don't want to hear. And one way to do that, one way to create that environment where people have the courage to speak up and they know that when they do, they'll be heard, is to, as you mentioned, John, express some vulnerability. And vulnerability, the way we generally advocate for leaders to do that is to start having dialogue with your team, with your team members, about how you can be better, how you can show up differently in the workplace, and maybe even express that you know and acknowledge that you're not perfect in all ways, and here are my weaknesses, and ask for that feedback. By admitting that you're not perfect, that you're fallible, it opens up the door for people to be able to contribute more. It's creating that safer environment.
I like what you're doing here in terms of the building blocks, right? The vulnerability, the humility you're referencing. And there's a third one in my mind, which is awareness, which may seem implied, but knowing that, you know, only 10 to 15% of people are truly self-aware at any given moment. I think that it's quite possible and probably happens quite often. I'd love to hear your take on this, that a leader thinks that they're doing all these things, or if you do hold up that thermostat to them based on the survey results, they think they're making the changes, but maybe not. How do you raise an honest level of awareness in the leader who's well-intentioned, but maybe just not getting it right?
That's a great question. And the way that we approach that is to employ as many of the principles of deliberate practice as possible to helping managers, leaders, and their team members, quite frankly, develop really specific interpersonal skills.
It would be great to talk about where the origins of that were and how it's been applied in different fields.
So the author that we have followed is Anders Ericsson. He's unfortunately he passed away a couple years ago, but his work lives on. And his most popular title is called Peak, and it's all about how individuals become excellent and great at things that are not that are psychologically based, so not just sports and music, where there's a really well-known means for practicing and getting better and better and better. And so when he looked at people that, for example, play chess, or people that can memorize thousands of numbers, or various other skills, he discovered that those who can get to that extreme level of greatness use a bunch of skills or a bunch of principles. And for example, one of the principles is to practice one skill at a time. And you see that in sports all the time. If you're, for example, learning how to play basketball, you don't just suddenly start playing a game. Instead, you learn how to dribble, then you learn how to shoot, then you learn how to pass. And in a game, you put all those skills together. So that's what we're, that's one of the principles that we're applying to help leaders practice and learn interpersonal skills is by practicing them one at a time. And we use that, we do that using our platform called SkillSetter, as you mentioned in the introduction. So SkillSetter is a platform for practicing these skills. So the way we do it is it's kind of like a flight simulator for interpersonal skills. We present leaders and managers with challenging situations. It's all actors acting out various scenarios that you might encounter in a team. And then when the video stops, your webcam turns on and you get to respond using one of the skills or maybe two of the skills. And so your response is short. It's 30 seconds, maybe a minute. And then a second principle is that you get to practice and do it over and over and over again with some level of feedback. So because we're recording your response, you get to record again and again and again until you're happy with your response. And we provide individuals with a rubric, a set of rules to follow when applying that skill. So when this skill is executed correctly, this will be true, this will be true, and this will be false. So therefore, they folks can evaluate themselves and see themselves, watch themselves, notice their nonverbals, notice how they're responding, and then get feedback on it. So once they submit their response, they get feedback. So this is something that generally as managers or leaders, we just never have that opportunity to get that kind of feedback, to see how we're doing, to watch ourselves in the mirror, so to speak, in a live interactive moment.
Let's talk about conflict. There are considerable distinctions in how conflicts are experienced in high safety teams versus low safety teams. For example, low safety teams might avoid conflict altogether, whereas high safety teams can embrace healthy conflict for better outcomes, like iron sharpening iron can only happen, you know, that only happens with a bit of friction. So how do leaders with high safety and high accountability teams, how do they tend to approach and mitigate conflicts or even encourage healthy conflict when appropriate?
I think first of all, you want to start with the mindset that there is essentially a psychological safety contract in your team where you want to hear oppositional points of view. And so you need to primarily accept that there's oppositional points of view and there needs to be room for those and you need to welcome those. So it starts by not just beating someone down or telling them they're wrong when you disagree with them. So there's some skill there. Secondly, there is potentially conflict between a leader and any one of their team members, but there's also potentially conflict between team members. And so one of the first skills that we really try to teach and have our leaders be thinking about is attunement, just being attuned to what's happening in their team and noticing how people are interacting and noticing if there's conflict there and being able to approach it, rather than avoid it, or rather than just quote unquote, put someone in the penalty box sort of thing and say, don't do that. If there's conflict, likely both sides have some meaningful, useful contribution to make to the discussion. And you want to be able to facilitate both sides to be able to hear what is the actual issue that the person is trying to elicit. Because often when conflict occurs, it's because the two sides are not listening to one another. And so it's about seeking understanding from others before seeking to be understood.
I want to just roll back to the challenge of organizations who've developed a culture that favors words like respect and really seeks to minimize any external manifestations of conflict in the workplace, and that drives these conversations down into into an underground kind of place. How do you start to get leaders to recognize their part in kind of perpetuating that culture where things can't really be spoken out loud?
The skill that we teach leaders is to make a process comment or to reflect process. So maybe I'll start. There's three levels of reflection. These are three separate skills. And I'll start at the top because I think it helps illustrate what the third skill is. So the first is the skill of reflecting content. So this is when someone says something or is trying to get a message across, you just say back to them what they just said. You don't say it, don't parrot exactly word for word, but rather paraphrase. So is this what you're saying? Is kind of the gist of it. You want to parrot back or repeat back to them what they just said to make sure that you understand and that others understand as well. So that's reflecting content, pretty straightforward. Most people can get that skill fairly easily. Then there's reflecting feeling, which is, if you can imagine, if the metaphor we use is that of an ocean. So reflecting content is the stuff at the top. And then if you go to the next layer, you're reflecting feeling. That's a little bit less obvious. Sometimes people are speaking and they're communicating, but they're not saying, I'm angry, I'm happy, I'm sad. They're not telling you what they're feeling. You have to decipher it based on their nonverbals or based on the tone with which they speak. And so then you say back to them, oh, I get that you're also feeling rather frustrated about this. Did I get that right? So that's reflecting feeling. And then the third is reflecting process. So this is deeper down. This is lower in the ocean. And these are certainly things that affect what's happening on the surface. And that this is the process. This is what's happening within the team. And so it takes a particular skill for a leader to be able to call out when there's this pervading politeness that's getting in the way, to be able to say, I'm noticing that people are just being really nice here. And how do we create more rigor in this team? How do we create more accountability? You need to not solve the problem, but shine a light on the problem. So that's what we teach these leaders, is to become the bystander within the team. Often as leaders, we think we need to have all the answers. We need to decide, make the decisions. And instead, we're inviting leaders to, yes, make the call from time to time. You absolutely have to. That is certainly part of your role. And when there is this sense of kind of stuckness, you need to be able to shine a light on it and say, what's going on? Why is this situation feeling so polite? That's a process comment. That's reflecting process. You're reflecting back what you're seeing and noticing within the team. And it helps generate conversation so that the team can work its way out of this norm, perhaps, that they've developed. That makes sense.
Yeah. Can we just talk a little bit about some of the work that you've done where you've made a real breakthrough with a team, especially a leadership team, and that's kind of had an effect on the overall culture? What kind of things do you see when psychological safety starts to take root in an organization?
Yeah, there was an incident where two members of the leadership team, they almost got into fisticuffs. So they disagreed. And in the past, that behavior would have just been shut down right away. And instead, using their skills, the team around these two folks that were really bumping heads were able to say, whoa, kind of time out just a sec, and yet not avoid the issue. Instead, approached it and said, okay, what's going on here? What's the real issue? How can we talk about this and figure out a reasonable solution? And they also felt a lot more comfortable allowing the conflict to occur and for each side to say their part. So they didn't just shut it down right away. They let it go on, and then they facilitated a smoother outcome so that in the end, they were able to resolve whatever that underlying issue was. And that was a real breakthrough for them, because they thought, gosh, in the past, we would not have been okay with that kind of conflict occurring in the moment, and would have shut it down and just moved on. And so that was a real groundbreaking moment for them.
Can we come back to what we were talking about earlier when you were talking about the importance of safety for creativity and innovation? And I think there's a distinction here in the safety versus accountability piece? Because I think, you know, I would assume that certain organizations that no longer exist, but once ruled their markets, might have been filled with very safe teams, but they were quite comfortable. There wasn't really a push for delivery or, you know, creating value for tomorrow. How do you see that play out? What is the importance of safety combined with accountability to unleash exponential creativity?
First of all, the value of psychological safety is about, it's about making decisions with full information, right? So that's why psychological safety is really valuable, being able to bring in all the different perspectives on various issues. And I think that you're right. I think that there are many environments where you get a little bit comfortable. And we had an organization that we work with like this, where they sold a variety of products in big box stores, and they were the incumbents. They were at the top of the game, and their market share could not grow because they were already the leading products in the big box shop. So they had very little opportunity for growth. And so they realized that their long-term strategy was around building brand new products, and ideally products that had IP protection, so they could they're unique and had unique qualities that they could get patents, and competition couldn't really compete. And that required a significant amount of shift for them, because their whole system was developed to protect what they had already built. So for example, their marketing team and their branding teams were all relatively risk averse. They all wanted to just protect the brands that they currently had. Their legal team, of course, was all over, protecting all the different products that they had. And so when they were looking to release new products, they had a very hard time meshing the new product team with the marketing team and with the branding team, because their need to create new products required them to be much more agile. And it was just conflicting with the overall safe nature, I guess you can say, of the organization. And so that's where they had to really go to work, is creating an environment where they had both that could exist and they could coexist. An environment where we were protecting the incumbents, which was 95% of our revenue in the current year and projected next 5 years. But if you project out 10, 20 years, we needed these new products to expand the revenue that they could generate. So that was a really interesting test case where you have these two conflicting cultures that really need to live under the same roof.
It's a great example.
Here on The Evolving Leader, we are committed to stretching the leadership conversation in every episode, and we invite you to help spread the word. If you have learned or been inspired by something you heard on this podcast, chances are others would too. Please consider sharing your favorite episode with your network on LinkedIn, Twitter, or Instagram. Thanks for listening. We're glad you're here.
How do you see psychological safety playing out intergenerationally, between sort of the older leaders in organizations and millennials and Gen Z?
Well, one thing that we've seen occur is psychological safety is a little bit, it can be dangerous. You open up the box for, hey, let's all be able to express our opinions. And what we see sometimes intergenerationally is that the younger generations are ready and willing to speak their mind, and older generations might develop some resentment towards those who they feel might or should be able to bite their tongue a little bit more. And so we definitely see that. Internally, we sometimes talk about psychological safety gone wild. So it's not always, as great a concept as it is and as great as the work that we do is, sometimes it can be misinterpreted, where suddenly I now have permission to say whatever I want, whenever I want. That's not it. I mean, obviously we want people to be able to share and communicate, but if I think you're being a jerk, I can't just say, you're a jerk. Or I want more money. I should get paid three times as much as I'm getting paid. That causes conflict. That causes issues. And we're seeing that. Is it purely an intergenerational thing? I wouldn't say it's purely an intergenerational thing, but if I could, just assessing the situations that I have seen where psychological safety has gone wild, I'd say that there's perhaps a little bit more of a tendency for younger generations to embrace it and want to be able to say whatever they want, and the older generations being a little more resentful. That's certainly a trend that I've seen.
Mm. Well, it's interesting because those kind of intergenerational values set the context for safety. You know, if we think of safety as being a universal kind of human need, you know, it's surrounded by context, and that context is different. If you've grown up where being respectful of people and listening first, and you know, particularly to more senior people in an organization, has been how you were drawn into the world, and how you grew up in organizations, and then you're met with people who go, no, I don't need to wait. I'm going to start talking about what I need now. That's that context clash, isn't it? Where you find that safety then gets undermined by what we believe to be our right in that situation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've seen some folks in the older generation not really wanting psychological safety. They want you to agree with them, and that's that. They want agreement. They don't want opposition. And when they are met with opposition, it's confronting. Then they might go into the fight or flight mode, namely the fight mode, and say, listen, I'm the senior here. I've been around the longest. I'll ask your opinion when I need it. That's not exactly creating an environment of psychological safety. It's not modeling the behavior that is ultimately needed for a psychologically safe environment.
I often tell my team, if you're always agreeing with me, you're going to make me quite nervous, because as smart as I like to think I am, I know I'm not always right. So please tell me. John tells me all the time how wrong I am. So I keep him around to
be my... I don't.
And I think that's a common misconception. I think a lot of leaders think, well, we don't have a problem here. Everyone is in agreement. We're all happy.
Right.
And that's a pure sign that you have low psychological safety. So low psychological safety doesn't mean people are warring and fighting and ready to kick each other in the shins. Instead, it means that they're just in agreement. Yes, sir. Mm-hmm. Right away. Yes, ma'am. I will do that. Okay.
And where do you think this field is going? What's next in your work and the research that you're involved in?
Well, the research that we're involved in, we are looking at assessing interpersonal skills and then correlating it with psychological safety. So the idea, the hypothesis, is that leaders and managers that have a high degree of measurable interpersonal skills are more likely to facilitate psychological safety in their team, and there should be a correlation there. So that's what we're studying. And the way that we're measuring psychological safety is similar to the way that we do our training, where we are exposing managers to challenging moments. We have typically 4 to 5 clips that are, again, 30, 60 seconds long, and they're challenging moments in a team. It could be one-on-one situations as well. And then you as the leader need to respond to that stimulus video, and we record the response and code the responses for 8 specific dimensions that we're looking for. And the way, the tool that we're developing is called the MFIS, so the Manager Facilitative Interpersonal Skills, Management Facilitative Interpersonal Skills. That's the assessment that we're creating and using in the study, and that is built off of previous research conducted in the world of counseling. So in counseling, there's many years of research looking at the efficacy of counseling, why it works, why it's useful. And what they've noted, what researchers have discovered, is that among all the different types of healers, not just counselors, but also they looked at religious leaders and counselors and psychotherapists and psychologists, etc. What was true among the best is that they all possess these soft skills, this ability to be empathetic, even when the client or the person on the other side of the table is belligerent or angry. And so Tim Anderson out of Ohio University developed this assessment to measure people's interpersonal skills. And in fact, what he did is he measured students, counseling students, before they went through training, and then they measured their results years later. And his assessment of their skills was predictive of client outcomes years later. So that to me is really fascinating, that you could take maybe 5 minutes of video clip of someone responding to challenging situations, and that's predictive of results down the road. And so that's the same approach that we're taking. We believe that by exposing people to challenging situations and recording how they perform, we can predict how they're generally going to create a psychologically safe environment. And part of the reason why we're doing it that way is because, let's face it, it's easy to be a manager when everyone gets along and everyone's in agreement and things are moving forward or hitting our results and quotas and all that kind of thing. But then when stakes are higher, when there's a bunch of change, like, oh, I don't know, COVID or something like that, and suddenly everybody's working remotely, that's when leaders have to really show their skills. And so that's what we try to simulate, is we've engineered these challenging situations to see how folks respond. And we can assess it. We can measure it accurately by having multiple raters, each looking at the same individual and coding them roughly the same. So we look for a high inter-rater reliability that says that different raters, if trained correctly, are all looking for the same thing. And so back to your question, where is the future going? So I think that the answer we're really trying to answer, the question rather we're trying to answer, is can these skills be learned? That's the ultimate question. And the first thing we need to do is measure the skills and correlate them with psychological safety, and then eventually show that there's not just a correlation, but a causation. So if we increase the skills, we can then increase psychological safety. So that's where we see our work. And there's a lot of technology to potentially help with that. So we're starting to leverage AI to be able to give real-time feedback to leaders and managers using this system, so that it's not just some expert who has to then give feedback that says, oh, maybe you should try this or try that. There would be instant feedback for leaders and managers noticing how they're interacting with folks and giving them instant feedback so they can adjust.
And in all of this analysis that you're doing, do you see any trends in terms of things that are changing in terms in people's reactions to different types of situation? Are some situations becoming more problematic, less problematic? How are we evolving?
Well, what we're seeing, this really interesting part of the study is, like I said, we have these clips of difficult, challenging moments in a team. And one of them is a character that we call Jackson. So Jackson is an individual who is very fixed in his mindset about what it means to be successful and professional. You need to show up 15 minutes early, and you need to do things in a certain way. And he's really rigid. And that type of an individual, the scenario we present is one where his team has a high level of turnover because nobody seems to be able to meet his expectations. And so there, on one hand, the organization appreciates his professionalism and his striving to produce results, and there's turnover. So what are they going to do about it? And so we have a script, and we've had a number of actors all portraying Jackson, this challenging person and the issues he's facing. And it's so fascinating the difference people react to when there's a male versus a female versus an African-American versus an Asian-American. It's amazing. With the same script, different actors, we get significantly different results. So for example, there is a younger African-American woman portraying Jackson. So it's, you know, went, but with a different name, obviously. And the sentiment or the feeling people had was, yeah, you go, girl. Awesome. Be strict and rigid. You know, you wanted to jump on her side because you felt like she had to fight for everything she had in her life. And so you're wanting to high five her saying, heck yeah, go for it. You know, you should have strict rules about when people show up. And then you have a Caucasian 50-year-old male portraying Jackson. And now you have a totally different reaction. So we have just really scraped the top of, you know, the surface in terms of diversity and cultural training that we could potentially do using this system, because it's amazing. Same stimulus. It's not the same stimulus. It's the same script, same character, and how we react is totally different. Totally fascinating in my mind.
What about you personally, Stefan? What deliberate practices are you engaging with at the moment?
Great question. So for me, part of my initiative is to be on more podcasts and be speaking, public speaking. So the practice that I'm doing for myself is around speaking and around sharing stories and around expressing to the world what it is that I think is so important around psychological safety and deliberate practice, etc. So that's where I'm really going to work is, and it's confronting at times to watch yourself and to get feedback. You know, you want to just believe that, gosh, I'm perfect and I don't need to improve, but it's tough work and it's really valuable and rewarding. So that's one area. And then the other area is around my fitness. So I've always been really generally pretty active in my life. And when COVID hit, I picked up the sport of mountain biking. And so I've been really trying to improve my skills on a mountain bike. And so every time I go for a ride, there's a bunch of different trails, but there's always features that I cannot do. You know, the jumps are too high or the rolls are too steep. And so I just go around them. And then every ride, I try to do one feature that I haven't done yet. Or also, I'm pretty active on Strava. I don't know if either of you have used Strava, but you can define segments on various training grounds and then time yourself. So there's currently one climb that takes about it takes me an hour, and I'm trying to get it down to 50 minutes because when I look at everybody in my age category that are the same weight as me, the best guys are doing it in 50 minutes. So I think, okay, well, I got to get it down from 60 to 50. So I'm working on that and putting in the time at the gym to make it happen.
Those are great. How can our audience get in touch with you?
So one thing that I'm offering for podcast listeners is to measure psychological safety in their team. So this is, if you're curious and interested about psychological safety, I'd love to measure the psychological safety in your team. As I mentioned earlier, it's a quick little assessment and it's spend an hour with your team to debrief the results and hopefully get a bunch of great value out of that. So if you're interested, the place to reach out to me for that is on our website, zorango.com/free PSI. So PSI stands for Psychological Safety Index. So it's Zorango, zarango.com/free PSI. And that's the best way to reach out to me. I'm also relatively active on LinkedIn, so people can always reach out on LinkedIn. The URL is /S, my first letter of my first name, and then Wiedner, S. Wiedner is my handle.
So, Stefan, thanks for coming on. We really appreciate your insights. And to our listeners, remember, the world is evolving. Are you?